back to the Stock Market Options Trading Podcast. I'm your host, Eric O'Rourke, and I've got a very insightful and extremely educational episode for you today. I got to speak with Matt Cashman, who is the principal of investor education at the OCC, or Options Clearing Corporation, where he educated me on essentially how the market functions on the back end. And we talked through the life cycle of an options trade, among many other things. It was extremely insightful. Now, as retail traders, there's a lot we take for granted when we place an order for an options trade. We place the order, we review and send, we hear the little bell when we get filled. And Matt's going to explain what really has happened after that trade gets filled. What has happened when we hear that little bell? Now, before we get into the episode, if you'd like to connect with myself or Matt after listening, come find us on LinkedIn. I'm sure most of you are working professionals and you probably pop in there from time to time. So come check it out. I'm going to put both of our links in the description of the podcast show notes, and you can simply click those or feel free to search us up. Now, let's get into my discussion with Matt Cashman from the OCC. Here we go. All right. We got Matt Cashman on the show today. How's it going?
Great. How are you, Eric? It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this episode. I love learning new things. And just real quick for our listeners, you and I met on LinkedIn and you were posting about some derivatives related stuff. And I saw you were with the OCC. So I was like, well, let me just see if I can get this guy on, because, as a retail trader, I've heard of the OCC and the OIC. There's a lot of acronyms I've heard of.
Yeah.
But I don't actually feel like I touch those things. And after talking to you, apparently I do. So I thought maybe you would just clear this up for the retail traders. I think it's, pretty fascinating with what you do. But before we get into the OCC, just give us a little bit about your background and maybe how you, ended up here at the OCC over the last, several years. I know you've been in it a while.
Yeah, I've been at it a while. No, I appreciate the brief intro. And I'm happy to talk about OCC and what we do here at OCC and its role in the entire financial world. But my background specifically, I started trading options in 1999. I got my start on the Board of Options Exchange, trading single stock options. I kind of came to it circuitously, as it were. I was actually a musician beforehand, and kind of 1999 was a very heady time as far as the markets are concerned. So if you want to go back and take a look at the NASDAQ chart from 99 to 2001, you'll understand what I mean.
What a time.
Exactly. It was a particularly good time also to be trading leveraged products like options, right? I mean, it's a...
Wow, I bet.
That was a very interesting time, but that's when I started. So I started trading options in 1999. I traded on the floor of the CBOE single stock and index options to begin with. After that, I moved over and traded. I've traded a little bit of everything, but after that, I traded the soybean complex at the Board of Trade across the street from the CBOE, and then moved to London and traded Eurex options that were traded on the Eurex exchange, the Boom Bubble Shots, which is the German twos, fives, and tens, the equivalent of the twos, fives, and tens, German treasuries. In London for about 5 years. And then I moved back to the United States and started an index market making operation again on the floor of the CBOE in 2005-ish, somewhere around there.
Okay.
And ran that with some partners up until 2015. Wound that down, took a little bit of time off, and then I ended up at OCC, where I am the principal of investor education. I essentially leverage all of that experience in the options world and teach people how options work. So my job is to better educate the public as to risks and benefits of exchange traded options, which is essentially what OCC deals in, right? Exchange traded centrally cleared options. My job is to make sure that as many people as possible out there understand the underpinnings of what these options, how they work, the math behind them, the actual kind of pipeline of players that exist in the background, and how the option market works more generally. So that's what I've been doing for the last probably 3 years or so at OCC.
Very cool, man. I have an IT background, and I know, things were so different like 15 years ago and maybe 20 years ago now when I kind of got into that. What are some of the, you know, maybe the biggest changes you've seen over your career? Maybe just with markets or the options market itself, like, you know, what's the biggest thing you've seen or the biggest maybe surprise that's happened over the last 20 years for you?
That's a really good question. And I think the answer to that for me is twofold. And one of them is a product of the other one. The first one is obviously the move to the electronic marketplace or the digital marketplace. And what I mean by that is when I started trading in 99 on the floor of the CBOE, the entire floor was full of, you know, 500, 1,000, 1,500 people. I don't know how many people were down there, but it was a lot of people. And we were in subsets of what we called crowds, which were trading crowds that had between, you know, 15 and 45 people. Within each one of those tiny trading crowds, there was like a big bank of screens that you looked at where mm-hmm. all of the prices for all of the options were, and you would have to update them as the stock moved up and down, right? Wow. Which is completely bananas when you think about it retrospectively.
Yeah.
But each one of those posts had a set of stocks. You know, we probably had 40 stocks that existed, and we had 40 TV screens that each had a matrix of prices on it. People would come in, ask for prices. You would give them prices. They would trade. And then, you know, you would either write it down or SIBO at that point in time was like the epitome of technological advancement. We had electronic handhelds where you could actually punch in your trade. Mm-hmm. Whereas across the street, when I went across the street to the Board of Trade, we were still using paper trades where you would write it down, who you traded with, and then you'd pull a piece of it off, keep what you called your dupes or your duplicates. You would keep your dupes in your trading coat pocket. And then the hard card that was like, yeah, like a credit card receipt would go to the clearing firm. And that was the record.
Wow.
So the biggest change that I have seen since that sets the stage for where I started. The biggest change that I have seen is obviously the utilization of computers into the trading environment and the move that people have made into a more digital environment to trade. Now, most recently, over the last 5 to 10 years, what you've seen is this proliferation of algorithmic trading that has just absolutely exploded. What comes with that is, if you think about an algorithm and its ability and a computer's ability to trade, the computer itself just naturally has more of an aptitude and an ability to trade more and faster. And so you're going to just get more trades. More trades means more volume, right? And more volume means more cleared volume. From the OCC's perspective, let's say in 2005 to 2008, we were dealing with cleared volume of between 3 and 5 billion contracts a year. Right now, we're dealing with somewhere between 11, probably this year, between 11 and 12 billion contracts of cleared volume.
Wow.
What that means is that there are far more people involved, and those people are involved in a more active way than they ever have been previously. I say that to kind of set the stage as to what we're dealing with volume-wise relative to where it used to be and the reasons why that exists. So that's really like what I think the biggest difference is just the central ability of the computer to actually make as many trades as it does on a daily, you know, hourly, minute by minute basis. And then the knock-on effects of what that does to volume more broadly across the entire ecosystem. It's an absolute explosion of volume over the last 20 years.
And
you can see it, right? If you go to the OCC, we have charts that give you volume over the last 20 to 25 years. And it's ridiculous how much volume there is now relative to how much there was before.
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw a fun fact online. I think there was 9-something billion contracts that the OCC cleared in 2021. Yep. So that sounds about right. You're up to 11 billion or so. I'm just kind of thinking like there's the computer, which makes things faster and easier, that type of thing. But there's also this increased number of expirations that we kind of talked about a little bit. SPX, zero DTE is probably the most, you know, the buzzword here, but it really just means there's daily expirations. And I'm starting to see that with things like, I think Rutt now is doing that and some other. It's just like, there's just going to be expirations every day. Do you think it's both of those that increase that volume so much? Or did you see that increase with computers alone? Or because, I mean, what are you seeing now with more expirations, I guess?
Well, I think the answer to that question is, in some ways, there would be no possibility for the complex to have daily expirations like it does, unless computers were as involved in the process and it were a more digitally native process.
Right.
So in that way, I think those two things are completely linked, and one couldn't happen without the other.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Now, as far as the daily expirations are concerned and how we got there, I think it's really instructive to look at the real history of how this happened, because there's a lot of rhetoric, particularly in the financial kind of news network arena, that focuses an awful lot on where the amount of volume is for products like the S&P in those zero DTE options. And while I think that's something that should be reported, I think what oftentimes people lack is a bit of a frame of reference historically as to how that has happened and why. Because I think if you tell the story from the historic perspective, instead of just looking at the snapshot of where it is now versus where it was 5 years ago, you get a completely different frame of reference for it. And that frame of reference is that this all started in 2005. And it's not something that started last year, right? It's been happening slowly over time. In 2005, and I can give this, you know, historical perspective because I was literally standing in the SPX pit in 2005 when the SIBO announced to everyone that the expirations that we had to deal with, which were every third Friday,
right?
The third Friday of every month was when we expired options. That would be the monthly expiration for that month. And all of the options for that month would expire on that third Friday. We're now going to happen every Friday. And it was going to be called weeklies. And we were all, as market makers, I was a market maker on the CBOE. And as a market maker, you take on risk when you are creating option volume that you're going to carry over time, right? You have inventory on different strikes and you have to deal with it and deal with the Greeks that are associated with it. And you carry these positions. You can imagine from my perspective and from all of our perspectives as market makers, we were pretty annoyed by the fact that our iterations of risk that were based in expiration were quadrupling. Right. You have to think about it from that perspective. We had an expiration that happened every month, and then we had an expiration that all of a sudden, because the SIBO said this, was happening every Friday, which was four times a month.
Right.
That's obviously a big difference.
That was in 2005?
That was 05.
05, yeah. Okay.
So weekly started in 05. And then pretty quickly after that, a significant chunk of the volume started to migrate into the weekly options.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it took probably close to 8 or 9 years. And in 15, I think they started and added added Mondays and Wednesdays.
Yeah, in 2016 maybe.
Yeah, 2016.
Yeah.
And so then you had Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Right.
In 2016. And then by that point in time, almost 30% of the volume was in an option that was a weekly option, right? That includes the Mondays, the Wednesdays, and the Fridays.
Right.
Okay. So you're talking about 30% of the volume already being there. And then in 2022, they add Tuesdays and Thursdays, round out the entire cycle. And so now you have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in these particular products that you have a daily expiration. And so now people are looking at, you know, the SIBO is releasing data that says between 40 and 50% of the S&P volume in options is centered in that zero DTE kind of complex. And that is true. However, when you put it in a historical context and you look at it from the perspective of like starting in 2005, that volume migration started and began. And it's just been a process that has slowly kind of increased over time. It starts to pull away a little bit of the, you know, people love to trot out the term systemic risk that exists, or, you know, some existential risk that exists because of these options. These options were not something that anyone cooked up in a lab and just dropped on to the actual marketplace.
Right.
They've been part of the process the entire time since 05. And anytime that I teach about zero DTE options, I always teach the idea that, and I said this to you before we hit record on this, every option in its life cycle at one point in time has been a zero DTE option. That day that it expires, that option is a zero DTE option, right? So if it starts its life as a 6-month option, it's a 6-month option. And then 3 months later, it's a 3-month option. And then right a month later, it's a 2-month option. And then up until the day that it expires, that option then becomes a zero DTE option just as a function of the time that's coming out of it. And so when I talk about it, I like to teach about how does time affect optionality more broadly, and then take that and kind of like cook it down into the real important parts about how optionality is affected on the last day of an option's lifetime. And that's how I think it's more effective to view these zero DTE options, because what that does is it allows you to impart a little bit more understanding on top of that situation that comes from a more broad base of understanding, instead of just looking at it and being like, oh my God, these options are crazy, right? Like that's not how you're going to actually learn about them or be able to manage your risk well. How you're going to be able to do that is by understanding the basics of the optionality and then applying that to what that option looks like on its last day.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good point. I know, there's definitely some confusion about when people say zero DTE, it's like those options are trading the entire time. Like their options are born, and I don't know exactly when they come out. I want to say it's 6 weeks is when they start coming out. I could be wrong on that.
What, the weeklies?
Yeah. Like,
how far out? I don't know exactly how far out the weeklies are listed. I don't think you can trade a daily expiration much past like a couple of months or 3 months.
Yeah. Right? I think it's a couple months that they're, you know, that those expirations are born and then they go away. But, you know, just zero DTE and, you know, with my group and stuff, that's really more, we refer to that as when we enter the trade, we're entering a zero DTE trade. Like if we had a trade that expired next week, we might say it's a 7 DTE trade and we don't even, you know, so we kind of refer to it upon the entry, but,
and I like that. I like utilizing that as a way to think about, because it gives you a general way to view your risk.
Right.
Thinking about options as like, you know, this is a 10 DTE option, right? It has 10 price iterations of settlement before it expires.
Yeah.
And thus, right, it gives you a way to kind of frame how, and it also allows you to give yourself a more educated perspective as to how the Greeks of that option are going to work, because options just generally from a Greek perspective look completely different with 10 days to expiration and 3 days to expiration.
Yeah. And I think I understand that. Yeah. I think the daily expiration is what it's helped, you know, retail traders like myself is, you know, if you wanted to be consistent with your DTE, which I think is part of a consistent strategy. And, you know, if you know how 30-day options work, well, now you can enter at any time and get a 30-day option, you know, especially, you know, we do a lot more spreads. So you don't have to think about like, well, should I go, you know, when it's Friday only, it's like, okay, well, should I go, you know, 36 days or should I go 20, you know, and you kind of have to choose. And not that it's not that big of a deal, but when you get down to like 7-day, you know, there's a big difference between 7-day and 3-day. You know, the way they behave, and it's really kind of gamma risk, I guess, but it allows you to be more consistent. So I, you know, I've always kind of seen that as it's more of an opportunity to apply a consistent strategy, obviously probably a shorter one. You know, it probably doesn't matter if you're doing a 45 versus a 46 day, you know, that's not that big of a deal, but it does, it, it, we think of it as it allows us to increase our frequency. So if you do have something that works for you on a smaller time frame, you're able to apply that more frequently as opposed to having to wait another 30 days or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you talk to the exchanges, and particularly the exchanges that list these options, that's exactly what they're going to tell you is the reason why they actually existed or began to exist is because they were getting requests from their end users, from their customers, that they wanted more granularity in their ability to hedge their risk.
Yeah.
They wanted to be able to hedge, exposure that they had in the broader marketplace on a Wednesday. And they wanted to be able to hedge that with an option that actually coincided with some other amount of risk that was maybe falling off on that day. And so they wanted the ability to hedge on a Wednesday. Previous to that, previous to the listing of the Wednesdays, you would have to hedge with a Friday option. And then what happens between Wednesday and Friday? If you have risk that's here on a Wednesday and it's falling off and your hedge is over here on a Friday, what do you have? You have 2 days of variance that I didn't want this. I don't want this, right? Yeah. And that's what people were complaining about. That's what the actual exchanges are going to tell you is the reason why they listed these in the first place. And when you think about it from their perspective, it's believable. Some of the things that I always write about are, home builders build homes and bridge builders build bridges and exchanges list options, right? They work on volume. That's how these exchanges actually make money. And it's not a bad thing. It's a part of the actual business model. But you should expect exchanges to follow the volume because that's the heart of their business. There's a lot of people that look at it and look at it critically and say why are they creating a more risky environment, blah, 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 blah. They're exchanges. That's what they do. They follow, right?
They
create products and they also respond to the requests from their end users, just like any business does. So
that reminds me, when you say responding to the requests of the users, there was a petition going around for the CBOE to change the increments of the SPX options from 5 cents to 1 cent.
Yeah.
And I had never even thought about that. I know most of the other ones are penny wide. I started thinking about that. It's like, yeah, they have all these expirations. And I'm assuming, I don't know if you can speak to this at all, but I'm assuming their systems are just hard coded with 5 cent, increments for the pricing. But, have you heard about that? Or, I mean, I know,
oh,
you,
yeah,
I know
I've
you
heard
know,
about
but
it.
I mean,
I'm not going to comment on
that increment or
it's hard for me to comment on that because that is something that's going to be decided at the exchange level.
Right.
And then, right, that's their decision. That's their business decision. And it's their decision as to how much, obviously I want you to also think about how much more bandwidth that requires when you're dealing with prices that have to be updated on a millisecond basis.
Mm.
You have to, think about an expiring put that's ostensibly worth almost nothing. The market on it might be nickel bid at a dime. Well, that put is going to stay nickel bid at a dime for a long time until it expires.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or until someone decides to sell it at a nickel and then it becomes zero bid at a nickel. But think about what that actually creates if you make it, you're allowed to say, I'm penny bid at 2 pennies, right? Mm. I'm 1-2, I'm 2-3, I'm 3-4. You're dealing with an increasing amount of messages that would be inside the current situation, which has basically two messages, right? Nickel bid or, is it nickel bid or is it at a nickel? Because the other side is kind of implied by that. And so it's a big difference in, operational risk, operational kind of the amount of just bandwidth that's required for those kinds of things. It's a big difference. And that's something
that
has to be, it has to be evaluated from a business perspective as well as a risk perspective at the exchange level.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
Well, I want to back out a little bit. I could talk about this stuff all day, but and listen to you. And but I do want to cover a little bit about it's something you mentioned before when we first talked. You mentioned, you know, kind of there's kind of this org chart of you know, once you place a trade, a bunch of things happens afterwards. And I think on the OCC website, one of the links you sent talked about the life cycle of a trade. And so as a retail trader, you know, I bring up my trade, I review it, I hit send, and then I get a little ding that goes bling. And it's like, you're filled. And I'm like, okay, cool. Right. So
what happened?
What has happened between that time that I hit send and I got filled? And that, you know, now if it's an SPX spread, sometimes it sits there forever because it's nickel wide and I got to raise it a nickel to get filled if I want to get filled right away.
Yes.
But regardless, once I get filled, what has happened in that, you know, sometimes microsecond for that to be an official trade in my account?
Let's start with the kind of high level, you know, there's a lot of ways to address that. We could get like super deep into the microstructure of exactly what's happening there. And I prefer to talk about it from a high level and talk about the players that are involved in that and the larger kind of architecture of how that works.
Yeah, let's do that.
The microstructure of it gets really right. There's a lot of variability built into that, especially now over the last 10 years. You know, much of what we talked about as computers get more involved in the high frequency involved, there's a lot of different microstructure that has created. But let's talk at a very high level of how the actual macro structure exists from the end user, particularly in this case. Let's talk about the retail trader. Okay. Your agreement is with your brokerage firm. You sign an agreement, maybe electronically, maybe back in the day when you opened your TD Ameritrade account, you actually signed a piece of paper and faxed it back to them. But your agreement thus is with your brokerage firm or your trading firm. So you are in agreement with your trading firm, and your trading firm is in charge of essentially overseeing your risk, making sure that your risk in your actual portfolio doesn't exceed your available capital. In whatever way they see fit, right? They're managing your risk and they're managing their own operational risk across their entire span of clients or end users. They then have a relationship with their clearing member or clearing firm. The clearing firm has relationships with lots of different brokerages, right? So imagine, five different brokerages that all have a relationship with one clearing firm. The clearing firm, in essence, basically treats its members, all those brokerage firms, just like the brokerage firms treat their end users, right? Okay. They are clients of those people and they pay for services and in turn get the actual access to the marketplace. The clearing firm is the firm that actually has the association and agreement with the OCC, which is the central cleared, you know, facility for the entire marketplace. So to review it, the OCC sits right here and we are the kind of end result of all of those trades. If you're making trades, they are going up to the OCC. Now, how do they get there? They go through your trading firm, which is who you signed an agreement with. Your trading firm has an agreement with a clearing member firm. The clearing member firm has a direct agreement with OCC. So when you trade, it goes through those levels up to OCC. Now, it's important to remember, OCC is not looking at your account. I can't see your account. OCC cannot see your account. Your account is handled by your trading firm. Okay. What we see from OCC is the resultant risk of all of those layers up to that waterfall from the clearing member firm that we have an agreement with and an association with. And then we have a bunch of clearing member firms that all feed into this central cleared counterparty process, right? So when you're trading, that's where it's going. Now, once it goes up to OCC, the other side of that trade is also coming up to OCC and everyone is kind of meeting in the centralized clearing facility. The interesting part about this is that centralized clearing is like an operated facility that essentially becomes, through this process called novation, the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. So let's say, Eric, you and I are trading and you're the buyer and I'm the seller. And we agree on a price and we agree on a quantity. You say, I want to pay three for 100 of these. And I say, okay, I'll sell you 100 at three. Right? Now we have created a trade. From our two sides of things, things go up through that waterfall that I just talked about, right? Mm-hmm. To our trading firms, up to our clearing firms, and then they meet at OCC. OCC then, through the process of novation, novation is actually technically defined as changing the counterparties in an agreement. And in this case, what that means is that instead of you and I trading against each other, we are both actually trading with OCC. OCC, okay. Because you're buying, becomes the seller to you. And because I'm selling, OCC, essentially through the process of novation, becomes the buyer from me. Now, why does that matter? The reason why that matters is because instead of it being what I call what the industry calls a bilateral agreement, bilateral meaning between you and I, it becomes a centrally cleared trade where all of the players that are involved go into this central counterparty, and the counterparty becomes the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. In the case of a bilateral agreement between you and I, if you said I'll pay three on 100 and I said I'll say 100 at three, and then 3 months went by and I said, hey, remember, Eric, when I sold you 100 of those at three, they just went out worthless. So you owe me $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't pick up your phone. Right? We've got issues. I carried the risk the entire time. It's time for me to get paid. And it's like, what happened? Where's the money? Eric's gone. He went to Brazil or Venezuela, right?
Right.
In the case of the centrally cleared structure, that doesn't happen. The centrally cleared structure is the structure that actually guarantees the structure of the marketplace.
Hmm.
For that reason, after 2008, the federal government created, I think, maybe 6 or 8 what we call SIFMUs, strategically important financial market utility. OCC is a SIFMU. What that means is that the federal government is looking at and designated these players in the marketplace and saying, this is strategically important to the actual functioning of the marketplace. And thus, we are going to actually create a moniker called a SIFMU, which then means you are regulated by all of the regulatory bodies. And so now all of these bodies that have three letters in their name, right? You can start with the SEC and call, all of the other bodies, now look at and regulate the actual operations of something like the OCC, because it's a SIFMU, because the government has said, hey, remember 2008 when things got super weird and we all didn't know whether or not Goldman Sachs was going to exist tomorrow?
Yeah.
We can't have that happen anymore. And so what they did is they created all of these SIFMUs, and then the government comes in and makes sure that all of them are operating correctly and within risk parameters. And so it's our job from OCC's perspective to make sure that we operate within those risk mandates, and that thus our clearing members that are all members of this centralized clearing facility all are also operating within their risk mandates. And so that's how that waterfall works.
Gotcha. Wow. That's
that was a long, long-winded answer to a very short question.
Well, and I just keep going back to as a retail trader, what things we come across and read about. And we don't even think about stuff like this. We just assume that, our money's going to be safe in here, and that if I buy something, they're going to honor it, kind of thing. And so it's interesting how that goes up the chain. What I started thinking about was the idea of dealer, in some of the option circles I run with, we talk about dealer hedging, and we talk about firms like Citadel, who, you know, potentially are sitting on the other side of your trade and maybe hedging out whatever your position is. So, you know, if I like just kind of a recent trade on a whim, I wouldn't say on a whim. Yesterday, the market sold off pretty hard right into like a key level. And just at the very last second, hey, I'm gonna sell puts here. And we bounced today and I took it off. So, you know, the idea that there's a person sitting on the other side that said, hey, I'm gonna buy a put here, and they matched us up in that mid second. Like, I have a hard time not believing that, but it just, you know, with the amount of volume going on, where do firms like Citadel and is there actually a person taking the other side of the trade? I'm sure there's matching up at some point, but can you speak to that a little bit about maybe where those type of firms sit in that that chart we talked about? You know,
yeah, absolutely. So the way that I can't speak to as to whether or not there is an actual person sitting in front of a laptop taking
right. Yeah, of course.
obviously, I don't necessarily know that, but I can speak to how that process works more generally. And this is kind of part of the architecture of how it's always worked. And what we're dealing with now is just that we're looking at a much more robust and faster version of how it originally worked.
Right.
Okay. So if you think about the transition back when things were transitioning from a pit environment, which I was talking about, into an electronic environment, what you're dealing with is, and I went through this myself, we created an electronic trading desk that sat upstairs above the pit and did its own thing. What we were doing was we were programming algorithms to respond to our values based on our models and put out prices. So if I had something worth three, my computer upstairs might be making the market on it 290 at 310. Saying I'll pay 290 for it and I'll sell it at 310. And if someone came in to that marketplace and said, I want to sell these at 290, right? They, what we call hit the bid, right? They hit the bid and they sell them at 290. Well, am I actually buying them? Yes. My risk, my pool of risk is actually buying it, right? The money that I have in the account that is backstopping my ability to put those prices out is, yes, buying them. What's actually buying them is my algorithm, right? My algorithm that is creating these orders out there, sending it to the exchange saying, hey, I'll pay 290 for 50 of these. I'll pay 290. I'll pay 290. I'll pay 290. It's happening over and over and over and over again. And so what happens is when you went in and sold puts yesterday, do I know whether or not Citadel bought them? And do I know whether or not someone on the other side of that trade actually hedged them? Chances are there probably wasn't a person who was actually like buying Eric's puts and hedging.
Right.
Right. Contrast that to how that trade might have happened in 2001 in the SPX, where someone had to like walk into the pit and say, hey, how are the, you know, 4,500 puts in SEP? And someone was like, I'll pay three for 50 of them. And he said, sold, I'll sell you 50 at three. That was like a person. Yes. A person definitely bought your puts. And then it got hedged by, they probably bought your puts and then bought spoos against it and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The amazing part about this marketplace is that that same idea still exists. It's just represented by an electronic means now, as opposed to two people screaming at each other across the pit. What that allows is for the actual resilience and the amount of the robust part of that marketplace where there's so many more people involved. And if you think about it from the perspective of the end user, the more people that are involved in this, the tighter the spreads actually generally become. And so whereas back in 2001, if you walked into that pit and said, how are the 4,500 puts in SEP, the market might've been three bid at 4.5, right? It might've been a buck and a half wide. Well, right now, what was the market on the put that you sold yesterday?
Yeah, I think they're nickel wide or so.
Yeah, it wasn't more than a dime wide, right?
Yeah.
And so think about that, right? As you get more people involved and you get more of those electronic means involved, the actual spread, the bid-ask spread, starts to actually collapse. Now, people in the market-making community call that margin compression. Mm. That's, you know, the spread from a market maker's perspective is always seen as like, how much money am I making when I'm trading? And as the spreads compress, their actual profit theoretically compresses as well. But the actual, the availability of your ability to build a business at scale through liquidity allows you to have that multiplicative effect in that regard. And so you don't need a dollar and a half wide market anymore. You can do it with dimes. You just have to be so much better at like slicing and dicing your risk, which is what these market makers now, like Citadel or like Susquehanna or, you know, Optiver, IMC, the large, right, market makers that are more or less electronic market makers, mm-hmm. that is their business. Their business is to be able to slice and dice risk, put prices out all the time, and make tiny, tiny bits of margin back and forth millions and millions and millions of times a day. That's what creates liquidity, right? And so,
and do they have to, you know, they have to try to stay delta neutral, so they would try to hedge out if it gets too one-sided, you know, like a net.
I mean,
you know, like if, you know, massive bull market run or something, like there's just calls being bought and puts being sold, you know, they would, I'm assuming they have to hedge that out with another instrument. Is that how they do that, you think?
They don't have to. I mean, they can operate, they can manage their own operational risks in whatever way they want. There's no mandate that says that market makers have to be delta neutral. And in many ways, delta neutral can be seen in so many different ways, right? I mean, the funny part about it is we could move our model around to the point and make our positions look delta neutral all we wanted to. Like the position itself wouldn't change. I can take the call skew and lower it like this. And if I'm short a bunch of calls and long a bunch of futures or stock underneath it, if you take the call skew and you lower it, what it's going to tell you is that you're long a bunch of delta.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the delta on the calls, theoretically, has just been lowered. That's where your short delta is coming from, and your long delta is coming from your long underlying. Well, if you take that delta and you lower it, your position is going to say you're long delta. Well, guess what? If I just take the vol back up on the calls, I'm delta neutral.
Mm.
And so you can do all kinds of like financial math to make your positions look delta neutral. The crux of the matter is they're allowed to manage their operational risk in whatever way they want, whether or not they want to hedge the trade that they took from you and bought puts and bought futures against it or bought underlying against it. That's up to them, right? But there's a lot of, oftentimes I look at, and I'm sure we follow some of the same people that talk about dealer positioning and what that means for the broader marketplace. Like, when you get close to a strike where there's a ton of open interest and dealers are theoretically short the strike, and you can do things and look at all of those things and try to read the tea leaves as to like what that implies for underlying movement. And people have been doing that for as long as open interest data has been available.
Yeah.
I've been doing that since like 2001. I can tell you that I can count on one hand probably the number of times where I've been correct, successful in predicting the time that it's going to happen, and managing my position adequately enough to make a decent chunk of money on it in my trading career. I'm not saying that it's a waste of time. I'm saying that insofar as it helps you to build a holistic idea of the marketplace, those things are good to think about and good to keep in your mind as far as building your risk kind of picture.
Right.
But I wouldn't go out there and say like dealer positioning is telling me that I should be long calls right now. Right. I mean, it's
Yeah, of course.
In some ways it's a fool's errand, right? There's so many different ways to hedge options. And what I was telling you before about delta neutral and just like me moving the call skew
and all of a sudden I'm delta neutral or not delta neutral, right? Mm. That's a perfect example of the fact that, like, you know, if dealers just want to be long calls and you're selling calls to them and they don't want to hedge them, they're not going to hedge them. And so you're making an assumption about the fact that, oh, well, everyone in this marketplace has to be delta neutral and thus has to hedge all of the other trades. Who knows who's hedging what and right. and how? And so, you know, like I said, I'm not saying it's a waste of time. I think people right. should look at that stuff and use it to build a holistic idea of the marketplace. But it's a little bit dangerous to be basing, you know, the entirety of a trading strategy on something like that, from my perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely, you know, look at, we factor that in a little bit, just as you said, it's more of a piece of the puzzle is to get an idea of where the market may go or where the market may not go. And you can structure, yeah. you know, trades accordingly. So, well, man, yeah. this, oh, gosh, I wish we had more time. We're coming up on the hour. Wait, this is, I, you know, it's funny. We hopped on. And I was like, oh, this is going to be, you know, a 10 minute talk about the OCC.
You did say,
I told you,
did
you that
say it was going to be short.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to have to set up another one.
I was thinking in my head, Eric, like, Eric's never interviewed me and I tend to talk a long time. It might not be short at all. So
yeah. Yeah.
Well, but I hope it wasn't too long winded. I try to just give as much, you know, information about these situations as I can kind of cram into these time periods.
No, this was awesome. I'm definitely gonna try to get you back on and we can just kind of keep going with other subjects, but this was great. I appreciate you coming on. Again, for the listeners, I'll put our LinkedIn information into the show notes so you can find Matt Cashman on LinkedIn to follow up with him on any questions or clarifications for any of this. But this has been great, man. I really learned a lot and I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, I'm so happy that I could lend a hand, Eric. Thank you for having me. It was fun.